KXL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
On Keeping the Faith today, we're talking by phone with Mark Johnson. Dr. Johnson is the Executive Director of the Fellowship of Reconciliation for the United States. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Steve. Good evening.
And we're going to be talking about books that you've been reading that you think our listeners might really enjoy or appreciate or learn from. But before we get into that, since you live in New York, let's talk a little bit about Hurricane Sandy and its effect on your operation there at Fellowship of Reconciliation.
Well, it's lingering. The storm struck as we were finishing a national council meeting, a board meeting, and moving into a staff retreat. We lost power last Monday, and we still don't have power in our national headquarters. We've sent everyone home after a productive few days, but the whole area is still sort of dragging itself back together. It was an amazing storm.
And you personally, I know from our chat earlier today, lost a sailboat. Sorry about that.
Lost a sailboat and a small ornamental pear tree in front of our condo as well.
Ah, too bad.
Yep.
Now, the storm hit very soon after you got back from a trip to Iraq.
It did. I got back on Friday, and the weather began to pick up, and it hit about 2 or 3 a.m. on Monday, so we could see it coming.
And how was the weather in Iraq?
Oh, it was delightful. It was 75, 80, and clear, maybe a slight sprinkle the last morning we were there, but just delightful to be out in the salt marshes in a T-shirt, being driven around on one of those lovely marsh boats and enjoying a day in the sun and the birds, and then to fly back to this weather, something else.
And tell us why you're in Iraq.
Well, the Fellowship of Reconciliation gives an annual award for international peacemaking, peacebuilding called the Pfeffer Award. And 2 years ago, we gave it to an organization called La ONF, which means no violence or nonviolence. And it's an organization that's distributed throughout Iraq, province by province or state by state, developing programs in nonviolence. And this was their second annual conference, and it was embedded in the fourth annual conference in civil society. So we went at their invitation, and one of the presentations had to be about the effort to save and restore the Tigris and Euphrates confluence at the salt marshes. So after the conference, we spent a couple of days out in the salt marshes as well.
And what was it about this organization in Iraq, No Violence, that warranted receiving this award?
Well, the Fellowship of Reconciliation is committed as a pacifist organization to nonviolence, both the sort of the spirit and manifestation of nonviolence and the practice of active nonviolence for social change. And after 10 years of occupation and what we see through the lens of media as being an environment in which there is a great deal of violence, this is a local civil society organization using the tools of nonviolence to try to create reconciliation and transition. Just one illustration, for example, they have a program where they have kids trade in toy guns and other sort of boring things for soccer balls and basketballs, putting them less at risk and getting them, teaching them to play. In fact, the day we arrived, there was an international marathon, 26 miles in Erbil, and we had an in-sympathy 2K walk in Basra. So there are thousands of people using sports as a way of getting to know each other and practicing peaceful coexistence, and that was what we were recognizing 2 years ago and watching yet today.
Now, were you the only representative from FOR, Fellowship of Reconciliation, who went to Iraq this time, or did others go with you?
I was the only one, but Terry Rockefeller from Families for a Peaceful Tomorrow was there. There were three folks from U.S. Labor Against the War who met with labor organizations there. And then there were another number of other European organizations present. There were about 21 of us at a conference of about 250 people from the West, generally speaking.
We've had representatives from Families for a Peaceful Tomorrow, families who had people die in 9/11 violence on this show before. I'm happy to hear that they were involved in this.
Yeah, Terry Rockefeller, one of the co-founders of Families for a Peaceful Tomorrow, was probably gets most credit for finally persuading me to take the leap here, and we had a great time.
Well, let's talk a little bit about books, but before we get into that, let me give the phone numbers. So if listeners want to ask a question of our guest today, Mark Johnson, you may call in. You may have a comment, or you may have a book to share as well. The phone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's, of course, within the 217 area code. That's 333-WILL. If it's long distance, you may punch in 1-800-222-9455. So long distance, perhaps you're listening on the Internet. Or our broadcast, of course, goes as far as Chicago and Indianapolis, so that's long-distance calls, too. But punch in 800-222-9455. Well, Mark, what have you been reading?
Well, you know, I'd really like to share some novels, but as a segue, let me point to two books on the environment. Between the hurricane here and the work being done to try to forestall the threats of violence through the control of the Tigris and Euphrates, I find these two pieces powerfully helpful. One is Christian Parenti's Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Parenti's a columnist for The Nation and a journalist, an American.
And spell that last name for us.
Parenti, Christian Parenti, Tropic of Chaos. And the other is by, I think he's a Welshman, Harald, H-A-R-A-L-D, H-A-R-A-L-D, Welzer, W-E-L-Z-E-R, called Climate Wars, Why People Will Be Killed in the 21st Century. And I find these both very, well, a bit frightening, but very helpful, because we're beginning to understand that, you know, just watching the tension around the gasoline lines here in New Jersey and New York and the deserved concern of people sort of at the periphery of the city but at the center of the storm, like Staten Island, we can already see the way in which large weather events sets people at odds. And when it becomes part of a political agenda, as the control of the Tigris and the Euphrates or the Yellow River or other rivers are, then the policy issues become front and center. So these are two ways of really beginning to think seriously about the next quarter to half century of political change around weather and climate issues.
And we'll add the Colorado River to that. Came back from Arizona a few weeks ago, and boy, are there fights over the water in the Colorado.
Yeah, I was struck. You know, the Euphrates no longer empties into the Gulf. It's completely diverted to make up for the loss of volume in the Tigris. And the Colorado barely makes it to the Gulf, and other rivers are held and used up. In fact, the other thing that was striking is that there used to be a great influx of water from Iran through the Kahrun River and the Arvan, and today no water makes it from Iran into what some would call the Shatt al-Arab or the Aravan. It's amazing that we are able to control these huge natural phenomena, rivers and climate, the way we are.
Now, the two books you mentioned on the environment, The Tropic of Chaos by Parenti, tell us in more detail about that book.
Well, Parenti is laying out some of the costs in terms of human advocacy around sort of the militarization of the issue of climate. So he talks first about the fact that the military is one of the most progressive institutions in terms of trying to understand climate, but that it's also seeing that the climate and weather become part of counterinsurgency problems globally. Also looks particularly at the Africa and Asian situation, the ways in which, well, we saw what happened in Haiti and in the Caribbean with hurricanes disrupting food distribution and the kinds of riots that follow from that. We watch with great concern the shifts in the monsoons in India, everything from the rise of suicide amongst farmers to the displacement of huge populations in India from dam projects. You know, FOR is involved in Colombia, and there again we see corporate entities displacing large populations for agribusiness purposes and water purposes. So Parenti looks at the issue of geopolitics as it relates to Africa and drug issues that flow out of the drought and the drugs of Afghanistan and Pakistan, looks at the issues of the melting of glaciers, and then finally turns to Latin America and the climate refugees that are moving around and being displaced in Latin America. So it's a global overview of large population impacts from the human impact on the climate.
Climate refugees. Are there any measures of how many people we're talking about currently?
Well, you know, it's a combination of climate and politics, but Colombia, for example, has the fourth largest internally displaced population in the world with a few million people, and millions of people are being moved in India. Arundhati Roy is another one who writes about the impacts of dams in India.
And that's primarily a result of the lack of water or the absence of water?
Or the displacement of people to create dams that will flood large areas to try to control water. You know, Welser says here, for example, far from a minor point, the world's population is generally expected to reach 9 billion by the middle of next century. And that would mean increasing numbers of people competing for dwindling resources. So in a way, it's probably appropriate to understand that the entire population of the planet is impacted by these shifts in direction.
And we're at 7 billion population now, I understand.
7 billion, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My allergies make it hard to probably to distinguish whether I'm saying million or billion, but I'll try to be more careful. Who publishes these books? Tropic of Chaos, Christian Parenti, P-A-R-E-N-T-I.
Right. That's published by Perseus Books, published by Nation Books, so Nation Magazine.
Okay. And Climate Wars?
Climate Wars is a Polity publication, Polity Books. And I think that's out of Europe.
And that, again, is Harald, H-A-R-A-L-D, Welser, W-E-L-Z-E-R.
Yeah. It was published originally in German by the Goethe Institute and then published by the Polity Press from Cambridge and then Malden, Mass. And that's, I think both of them are 2012. The Climate Wars is 2012. Parenti's book might be 2011.
Now, the subtitle to Climate Wars, Why People Will Be Killed in the 21st Century, is certainly grim. What does Welser cover in that that volume?
Well, he's talking both about the issues of ecocide, so that as you deforest and desertify, you know, populations are killed. You know, the salt marshes are an illustration. In the 1950s, there were 60,000 marsh Arabs across six different tribes living in those marshes. Saddam Hussein drained the marshes partly to have access to rebels who were locating there because they were impenetrable. And then he used the dried and drained marshes to march his troops across to the war with Iran. So those are illustrations of, again, the sort of the intersection of goals of militarism and the use of the environment. Let's see, it's been a little while here since I looked. I pulled these out because of our
hurricane
reference and the reference there. But there's the other thing I like about Walser is it's data-based and it's global in its characterization. So he graphs out the impact of global warming and social catastrophes across about 24 nations and reflects on the Kyoto agreements and the climate issues as well.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with Dr. Mark Johnson, who is the Executive Director of the United States Fellowship of Reconciliation, an international peace organization, in fact, the oldest of the peace organizations with an international ecumenical approach. We're talking about books that are worth your considering reading. What other books have you been reading, Mark? I know you often have 5 or 6 going at the same time.
Dozens going at the same time.
All right.
It was fun to read Joe Quinnan's piece in the Wall Street Journal last week about reading hundreds of books at the same time. You know, to segue, I do want us to talk about Mario Vargas Llosa's The Dream of the Celt. But to get there, I also want to stop for a moment at Eliza Griswold's book, The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam. It's brilliant. I think everyone should be reading it. I was on a speaking tour last year, and someone set me up in the most positive way with an ROTC instructor at Siena College in Buffalo. And he referenced the fact about the military's excitement about having access to what he called the 1040 window. The 1040 window is this band along the 10th parallel through Africa and Asia that sort of marks the division between the Islamic and the Christian world. Eliza Griswold is the daughter of the Episcopal Bishop Frank Griswold, and one of the most poignant moments is when she's sitting with Franklin Graham about to go in and meet Bashir, the Sudanese dictator.
And Franklin Graham is Billy Graham's son.
Billy Graham's son. So you have these two preacher's kids looking across the table at one another. Eliza, a journalist who is skeptical, I'll say, if not even critical, of the way in which religions are brought face-to-face in the world. And Franklin Graham, who's sort of at the front lines of advocating a continuing Christian evangelism in the face of Islam. And Franklin Graham asks her if she's been saved. And she suddenly has this moment of reflection about what that question must mean to Franklin Graham and his father, Billy Graham, and what it meant to her, especially as she reflects upon her father's being consecrated as a bishop in the Episcopal Church. But the book is powerful because of the reminder it gives us, like Phyllis Bennis and others, that not everything about the conflict between Islam and Christianity has everything to do with the United States and nothing about the rest of the world. These are conflicts that are seated in long-standing confrontations driven by, as Karen Armstrong would say, greed, envy, and ambition rather than religion per se.
And give us the title of the Griswold book again.
The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam. And she starts in Africa and then works across the Middle East and ends up in Asia. So the book falls into three pieces. But she's an amazingly courageous journalist who works really at the front lines of these conflicts.
Mark, we're at the 20-minute point, and I need to take just a second to remind listeners that you are hearing Keeping the Faith here on WILL AM 580, as well as a simultaneous broadcast at 90.9 FM HD3, if you have one of those nice HD radios. We're also heard online, and people may be hearing us at will.illinois.edu/AM/keepingthefaith. So we are being heard in many places. Let me give the phone numbers again for listeners who might like to call in with a comment or question, 333-9455 in the 217 area code. If you're long distance, there's a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. I'm Steve Shoemaker, your usual host for Keeping the Faith. And I might just mention that next week we'll be talking with Reverend Reggie Weaver, who's pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of Chicago, about what it's like being pastor of a very multicultural interracial church. That's November 11 here on Keeping the Faith, 5 p.m. Central Time. Well, let's get back to our guest today, Mark Johnson. Mark, you're talking about Eliza Griswold's book, The Tenth Parallel, Relations Between Christianity and Islam Around the World. You said that was something you wanted to mention on the way to talking to another book, talking about another book.
Yeah, let's move to a novel. Mario Vargas Llosa's new novel, The Dream of the Celts. It's a historical fiction, and it's the story of Roger Casement. I probably picked it up for a number of reasons. First of all, it's setting at the beginning of the 20th century, which was sort of the time at which the pacifist and nonviolent voices of the world were sort of rising to public and political prominence. And this is the story of an Irishman who was, on behalf of the English, sent first to the Congo to write a white paper of criticism about King Leopold's Congo and the rubber plantation and empire that Leopold was given there. The paper was so powerful that English policy changed, and the future of Leopold began its downward swing. But it was also the paper and the study that began to introduce the world in a global sense to the way in which empire wreaks havoc and desolation. And it was probably an embarrassment in some ways to the English, and it lifted their sights in a way that then sent Casement to Peru to look at an English company that had, in a similar fashion, taken over the rubber industry in the Amazon Valley. And the interesting thing about the two episodes was that it led Roger Casement to change his appreciation and understanding of the relationship between Britain and Ireland. And while he had been knighted and lifted up for his work on the Congo and the Amazon, in the end he was hung as a traitor because of his advocacy for a free Ireland. And this was a result of his efforts in some ways to forestall the First World War, but secondly then to engage the European powers, and Germany particularly, in an effort to free Ireland from England. It's a wonderfully written novel, and just the themes, again, are powerfully contemporary in the sense that corporations, even at the beginning of the 20th century, were proving more powerful than the state and were exercising enormous kinds of impact on large populations across large areas.
The Dream of the Celt.
The Dream of the Celt by Mario Vargas Llosa, the Nobel Prize winner from Spain.
We're talking with Mark Johnson. Let me encourage listeners to join the conversation, ask a question, make a comment, or perhaps mention a book that deals with some of these same issues, some of these concerns. 333-9455 or long distance 800-222-9455. We're talking with Mark Johnson, who's the Executive Director of Fellowship of Reconciliation of the U.S. Mark, you've said you're going to be moving toward retirement soon. When will that be?
Sometime during the course of 2013, I crossed that threshold that a lot of us baby boomers saw as a retirement threshold. I turned 65 this year, so F4 is just beginning the process of developing a search, and I've said I would stay as long as it would be helpful in terms of that transition, probably at least through the mid part of next year.
And how long have you been the director?
5.5, approaching 6 years. I started in 2007.
You've had a busy half of a decade here.
I have. I've got a wonderful staff that has a reach and engagement that is inspiring. Just before I went to Iraq, I spent 8 days in Colombia, where F4R USA has one full-time director staff and 5 volunteers, 3 of whom live in protective accompaniment with peace communities in the Yoruba province in northern Colombia. They're partly to assess what impact the current peace negotiations between the FARC and the Colombia government might have on our work, and partly just to see what transitions are appropriate as this work continues over its now 10th year into its 11th year.
Now, your PhD, as I recall, was from Columbia in sociology?
That's right, yeah. I was on the right to privacy, as determined by the U.S. Supreme Court over 100 years of case law, which has been fascinating to watch resurface this last week as the new season begins and the U.S. Supreme Court's again listening to cases on invasions of privacy through police forces using dogs and other things. So the topic never goes away.
Well, let's continue with our discussion about books. What else would you recommend to listeners of Keeping the Faith?
Well, when you and I were together recently, we were wondering what familiarity this audience might have with graphic novels, the use of cartoon-type or comic book formats to tell stories. We were interested partly because in the late 1950s, the Fellowship of Reconciliation published a comic book called The Montgomery Bus Story, which told the story of the use of nonviolence following Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott. And the comic book then had an appendix on active nonviolence and its use as a tool in the civil rights movement. And we were interested because recently it's been translated into Arabic and Farsi and Italian and Spanish and other languages and used as a part of educating the public during the Arab Spring about the role of active nonviolence. But I mentioned that to lift up Harvey Pekar and J.T. Waldman's Not the Israel My Parents Promised Me. Those who think Pekar's name, Pekar, might ring a bell, it's because he was best known for his graphic autobiography called American Splendor, which became a well-received movie. But this book is a fabulously effective overview of the Israel-Palestine conflict, and I'd highly recommend it as Harvey Pekar's final book. He died in 2010, and so the J.T. Waldman was his collaborator who saw the book to publication.
And how is Pekar's name spelled?
P-E-K-A-R, Harvey Pekar.
Not the Israel My Parents Promised Me.
Right.
And it's a graphic novel.
It's a graphic novel or a graphic history book. It's like Joe Sacco's work on Palestine and Gaza and Bosnia and Kosovo. One of the things that's really got me thinking is that as Pekar moves across the history of Islam and Christianity and Judaism, he uses graphic motifs that reflect in a way that I can't imagine text doing, sort of the nature and culture that he's writing about. So you have this period of maps that have sort of a Persian miniature feel to them, and then you have another set that has a mosaic quality to it, as he talks about Jerusalem in the Middle East during the period of the Roman conquest. And it's just it just reminded me of the ways in which the visual can be used to enrich the text subtly but effectively.
I have been teaching a course here for the last seven weeks through the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute here at the University of Illinois, OLLI, on local Christian art and architecture as well. But this last week we went to the rare book room of the library and saw some of the ancient illustrated manuscripts, the wonderful visual additions to the at one point handmade texts, and then later after prints came in the 16th century, all of the illuminated printed books as well as the illuminated manuscripts. And of course the University of Illinois has a wonderful collection of these things, and the class was just delighted to see some of that collection. And although a graphic novel isn't illuminated in the same way with the gold on vellum, it's it also adds the visual, as you say.
Yeah, and illuminated really would describe the style used in some of these chapters. From part of it is to evoke sort of a feeling of a the Middle East of a millennium ago, and then when he gets into the more current era, there's almost Art Deco type illuminations along the edges, and as you get into the very current, things are suddenly presented like in the form of advertisement. It's just it's a powerful presentation. Pekar is the son of Zionist parents, one religious and one non-religious, who came from Poland in the 30s, but still related to the experience of Germany in the 30s and 40s and 50s and the Holocaust and so on. But he's coming to terms with also his understanding of what has happened in the Middle East more recently, and from his perspective, the fact that it doesn't align fully with the Zionism that his parents tried to educate him to. So it's a powerful piece.
We'll be talking here on Keeping the Faith, our first program, the first Sunday in January of 2013. We'll be talking long distance, if all of the technology works correctly, with someone about the Orthodox Christmas Eve as celebrated in Bethlehem. Uh-huh. And so we'll be having a broadcast sort of directly from a live broadcast from one of the Palestinian territories. Bethlehem, of course, is on the West Bank. And so that'll be coming up January 6th here on Keeping the Faith.
I have on my lap right now a lovely little photo book called Guardians of the Mosque, African Palestinians of Jerusalem. It's by Andrew Courtney. And it's one of these sort of published on-demand books by a company called Blurb. Have you ever heard of Blurb?
I have not.
Yeah. So you order it, and they print it for you and send it to you. And Andrew is a local photographer. He's from Westchester County near us. But this book represents I think it says, 2 decades of his ongoing relationship to the African Palestinians of Jerusalem. And this is a small group of African immigrants who lived in Jerusalem close to the Bab el-Sharif at the foot of the Temple Mount of Al-Aqsa and guard its gate. And it's a lovely series of portraits of that family there by Andrew Courtney.
How is that last name spelled, Mark?
C-O-U-R-T-N-E-Y, Andrew Courtney's Guardians of the Mosque, African Palestinians of Jerusalem. And so already we've moved from the sort of deep scholastic and social research of climate through social science and journalism to novels and graphic novels and now into photographs. So we're getting further and further away from the written word, but still staying, still giving a lot of attention to that 10:40 window.
Let's talk about other books you've been reading. Our guest today is Mark Johnson, Dr. Johnson, director for at least another several months of Fellowship of Reconciliation in the USA. Other books, Mark?
Well, let me lift up another mixture of journalistic reflection and graphic novel. This is a collaboration between Chris Hedges and Joe Sacco. I mentioned Joe Sacco earlier because of some of his work on Gaza and Palestine. They have a book called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. And this one is interesting because the first half of the book deals with the experience of Native Americans in the United States and the continuing difficulties of that population as a part of American culture, and then looks at the situation in Israel-Palestine. But it's sort of a broad reflection on the practices of resistance and revolt that is sort of alternating in its illustrations, both in the Hedges, often sort of apocalyptic post-New York Times essays and Sacco's pieces. It reminds me, Steve, another event that's just taken place, which I think is powerful and interesting. The Fellowship of Reconciliation is one of those organizations which, for much of its history, has arranged for delegations to go from the United States to areas of conflict. One of the reasons I went to Iraq is because before the invasion of Iraq, FOR had put together a delegation along with some other groups to sort of be present in resistance to the initiation of that war in Iraq. And some of the people on our trip, it was the first time they'd gone back in the 9-10 years since that experience. And at the same time that I was in Iraq, there was a delegation through the Interfaith Peace Builders, a delegation work of that started at FOR and the Dorothy Cotton Institute. And it was a group of civil rights legacy leaders, people like Dorothy Cotton and Vincent Harding and emergent black American voices like Lucas Johnson and Reverend Osikfeyu Seku, along with a half dozen other rabbis and pastors who visited Israel and Palestine to sort of assess the joint struggle approach of understanding of what the civil rights movement in this country might have to offer by way of both understanding and moving beyond the conflict in Israel-Palestine today. So Chris Hedges and Joe Sacco's work reminds me of the kind of hope in the end that arises out of this process of looking at conflicts over time and around the world.
We're about 20 minutes till the end of our Keeping the Faith program here today, Sunday, and we're talking on November 4th, 2012. I need to repeat that occasionally because we have so many people who listen to these programs on podcasts. I need to make sure that people know who are listening live what's coming up soon. People who listen on podcasts, of course, may have missed some things. Let me mention that the University YMCA, where both Mark and I have in the past served as director here at the University of Illinois, is sponsoring this coming Wednesday, November 7, 2012, at 7 p.m., the last of the Global Lens film screenings. We've had 10 of those this semester, and this is the last. This will be a Turkish film called Toll Booth. That's Wednesday, November 7, 2012, at the University YMCA. The Global Lens Film Series tries to promote cross-cultural understanding through the use of cinema. It's sponsored by the Arts and Faith Committee of the University YMCA that's staffed by Ann Ramses, Program Coordinator. So that's this Wednesday at 7 p.m. at the University Y, the corner of Chalmers and Wright Street. That's 1001 South Wright on the campus of the University of Illinois, right across from the newly reconditioned Lincoln Hall. So that's Wednesday night, Global Lens film screening of Toll Booth, a contemporary award-winning film from Turkey. Coming up on Keeping the Faith, next week we'll be talking with Reverend Reggie Weaver, pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of Chicago, about what it's like being a pastor serving a very multicultural, interracial church there on the far south side of the city of Chicago. We'll continue that theme the next week, November 18, but move to a church in Overbrook Church in one of the suburbs of Philadelphia. Or I say one of the suburbs, it's sort of right on the edge of the city itself. We'll be talking with the pastor there, Reverend Wallace Buber. That's also a very consciously interracial, multicultural situation. So we're doing a little mini-series here on the 11th and the 18th on Keeping the Faith. On the 25th, the Sunday right after Thanksgiving, we'll be playing an archive program because I'll be traveling. An interview we did last June about a brand new book by Dr. Ron Sider, theologian, founder of Evangelical Christians for Social Action. His book is called Fixing the U.S. Moral Deficit. That'll be November 25th. We'll be playing an archive program with Ron Sider talking about his book. I'm Steve Shoemaker, usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. You're listening to WILL, AM 580, and 90.9 FM HD3. If you've missed part of this program, you may, of course, hear it when it's put into our archives, which will happen in a week or so, and all of our other previous programs, almost all of them, going back several years, are available for you to listen to at your own convenience online. And that can be found at will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. And just leave the G off of keeping, and you'll find a whole list of our past programs. If you want to search for other interviews with Mark Johnson, for example, simply put his name in the search box on the website, and you'll see several times we've interviewed him about books and about Fellowship of Reconciliation. But we still have time today for calls, so 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455 with a comment or question for our guest, Mark Johnson. Other books, Mark?
Yeah, let me put another set on the table, sort of following from your interfaith, intercultural perspective. Daniel Philpott, P-H-I-L-P-O-T-T, is at the Kroc Institute at Notre Dame. And he and two other authors last year published a book called God's Century, Resurgent Religion and Global Politics. And the thesis that they were investigating was the the late 20th century hypothesis that the world was becoming more secular and that religion would have less and less of a role to play in global politics versus the 21st century's experience that, in fact, as the subtitle says, resurgent religion and global politics, we find ourselves in a context where religion is certainly an attribute of leadership and conflicts that are hard to dismiss, and that the path to secularism seems to have been reversed in many ways.
Mark, I want to hear more about that, but we do have a caller waiting, and I don't want to keep them on the line too long. And since you're in New York and can't see our flashing lights, let me go to line number one. Yes, our caller on line one. Go ahead.
Hi. I was so happy to hear someone from the Fellowship of Reconciliation. I have often seen your beautiful Christmas cards and often sent for them and used them. And I wonder if, I don't know if you have a catalog. You haven't had one for a couple of years, but is there a telephone number? I can't seem to find one in my address book. Can you give me a telephone number where I could get information about your cards this year?
What you really want to do is to go to our website, www.
No, it isn't. I don't want to go to your website if I can avoid it. But
okay. It's 845.
Okay.
358.
Hold on. 845-358.
4601.
4601.
And let me repeat that number for other listeners who may have been searching for a pencil or pen. That's 845-358-4601, a phone number for Fellowship of Reconciliation for their cards and other items. And Mark,
yes. What is the website again? I'm sorry. Tell me again what the website is, because perhaps you show them on there.
Yes, it's www.forusa.org.
Forusa.org. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. Appreciate it.
Just a reminder that we do not have power and have not had power for a week, and so our telephones are not working, but you can still access and make orders through the website, though we now collaborate with the Stony Point Center and its gift shop as another source for our cards. But
what else is at the FOR shop?
Well, it's a fairly reduced and modest collection. There is some calendars. We do, whenever we review a book, provide a link to an internet purchase capacity there. But mostly a few of our most popular cards continue to be a part, plus a CD of a wonderful set of songs by Bayard Rustin. We celebrated his 100th anniversary this year, and most people who know Rustin at all know that he had a beautiful singing voice, and we have a recording of those. I mentioned the comic books, the Martin Luther King comic books, which are available in quantity for use. And we also carry some pamphlets by Richard Dietz and by Walter Wink on nonviolence and on homosexuality in the Bible. So there are a variety of resources available at the website or by leaving a message at the telephone number.
And I'll repeat that. FORUSA.org is the website. And because the National Office of Fellowship of Reconciliation is in New York, which is still recovering from a hurricane, they still don't have electricity where they are. So their phones are not operating now. But later you may call them at 845-358-4601. And Mark Johnson may not be there to answer the phone, but he might. You never know. Mark, tell us, we were talking when we had that good call with that question about God's Century, Resurgent Religion and Global Politics. I was struck by what you said, how that just a few decades ago, people were saying, well, religions are all dying out. This is becoming a secular culture, whether it was clear back to Harvey Cox's The Secular City, things have really changed. And I know since this program has been on the air since 1999, the concern about religious issues, trying to find more knowledge about different religious traditions. That's been one of the reasons this program continues to be quite popular.
Yeah. And I introduced that book because it's the foundation piece on which a more recent publication has been published called Just and Unjust Peace, An Ethic of Political Reconciliation. You can understand why someone interested as the Fellowship of Reconciliation might be drawn to a book on an ethic of political reconciliation. But this is Daniel Philpott's argument that after looking at the 40-plus Truth and Reconciliation commissions that have followed from that established at the end of apartheid, there are six practices that define an effective process of reconciliation at the state level. Like Eliza Griswold's book, I would just love to see lots of people reading this book and thinking about how we transform the conflicts that still plague the world, whether it's in Afghanistan or Iraq or Sri Lanka or East Timor, might find a path to reconciliation through the practices set out by Daniel Philpott in Just and Unjust Peace.
You've mentioned several times active nonviolence in distinction from pacifism. Tell us what that means.
Well, it's not so much a distinction from pacifism as it is the reminder that a pacifist is not necessarily pacific. A pacifist can be active in the world, and the use of nonviolence as a strategy, grounded in a still more rich and deep theoretical framework, a framework advanced by Mahatma Gandhi, for example, in his concepts of ahimsa and satyagraha, and in Martin Luther King's work of the strength of love. It's a reminder that those who want to affect social change have to engage actively in that, but consistent with our beliefs in the peace witness and the peace message and peacemaking. The engagement is through practices that are nonviolent in character, that do not injure people, that respect individuals and the humans and the earth, but still will resist the use and abuse of power and violence in the world.
Mark, we're down to our last 3 or 4 minutes before we have to do our closing announcements. One last book to tell our listeners they might consider reading.
Well, you and I both have a personal love of poetry, and I've just finished Mary Oliver's A Thousand Mornings, her most recent book of poems. And as always with Mary Oliver, it's just such a delightful, honest, open engagement with the natural world, the world around her. Beautiful poems. She does have one on hurricanes that I was struck by. I was also reading John Updike's posthumously produced Endpoint and other poems. They make a nice pair to be reading. Might I close with a bit of Hurricane from Mary Oliver?
Please do.
It didn't behave like anything you had ever imagined. The wind tore at the trees. The rain fell for days, slant and hard. The back of the hand, everything. I watched the trees bow and their leaves fall and crawl back into the earth, as though that was that. This was one hurricane I lived through. The other one was of a different sort and lasted longer. Then I felt my own leaves giving up and falling. The back of the hand to everything. But listen now to what happened to the actual trees. For the end of that summer, they pushed new leaves from their strubbed limbs. It was the wrong season, yes, but they couldn't stop. They looked like telephone poles and didn't care. And after the leaves came blossoms. For some things there are no wrong seasons, which is what I dream of for me.
A poem by Mary Oliver from her most recent book of poetry called A Thousand Mornings, published by
Penguin Press.
Penguin. Mary Oliver, A Thousand Mornings. Well, we are out of time, Mark. Let me thank you for bringing your tired voice to our radio. We were able to understand you just fine, but after having gone through a hurricane and just back from over a week in Iraq, thank you again for being on this program and talking about books of interest to our listeners.
My pleasure. Thank you, Steve. It's always a pleasure.
Again, we've been talking with Dr. Mark Johnson, Executive Director of the Fellowship of Reconciliation of the United States of America. For more information about FOR, go to forusa.org or call 845-358-4601. I'm Steve Shoemaker, your usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Let me mention again, we've had support for these Keeping the Faith programs for many years from the University YMCA here at the University of Illinois, the oldest student organization here on campus, started back in 1873. Mentioned fairly recently on 60 Minutes with a recent interview of a Pakistani young man who came here and stayed at the Y before he developed, went to university in engineering and became a very successful person, Shahid Khan. But at any rate, the Y is continuing its work of promoting cross-cultural understanding, in this case through the use of cinema. And the 10th in a series of films will be shown this Wednesday, November 7, 2012, at 7 p.m. at the Y, a Turkish film called Toll Booth, sponsored by the Arts and Faith Committee of the University Y, staffed by Ann Ramses, program coordinator. Again, that's Wednesday, the 7th of November, 7 p.m., Toll Booth, a Turkish film. Coming up on Keeping the Faith in the weeks ahead, I'm happy to announce we're having a little series the next two Sundays, November 11 and the 18th. Both Sundays we'll be talking with pastors who are serving multiracial, multicultural Christian churches. One in Chicago, Reverend Reggie Weaver of the First Presbyterian Church of Chicago. And on the 18th, Reverend Wallace Buber, pastor of the Overbrook Church in Philadelphia. Both of those conversations will take place by phone, but we encourage listeners to join those conversations by giving us a call. Let me remind listeners that if you missed part of this program, you can hear it online at your convenience on many different devices. Go to will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. I'm Steve Shoemaker, your usual host. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM.